Well, for those of you who are new, I'm Lynn Willis, and I'm a retired professor of pharmacology from Indiana University, and where I did basic research for 30 years or so and taught pharmacology to medical, dental, nursing, and assorted other students. And somewhere along the way developed an abiding interest in over-the-counter medicine. I guess that stems from the fact that my undergraduate training was in pharmacy. And so I've always grabbed opportunities as they came by to discuss over-the-counter medications with folks who may not be too familiar with them. And that's how we come to be here. What I plan on doing today, and we can freewheel it a little bit if you're so inclined, was to finish a discussion of what I would call the conventional over-the-counter drugs. That would be the ones that you see most in abundance when you walk into the drugstore or the grocery store and go down the medication aisles. Tylenol, among the pain relievers, the brand name laxatives and allergy meds and so on. Those would be conventional over-the-counter drugs, as opposed to the dietary supplements and the herbal remedies that sometimes are on the shelf right alongside some of these others. In other places, they are off by themselves. And I'm separating these out because we have two different laws in this country that regulate non-prescription medicines. There's the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, which was adopted in 1938 and has been amended several times up through the 70s. And this law is the one that regulates prescription drugs and these conventional over-the-counter drugs. And it regulates them very tightly. The FDA is a no-nonsense organization where these remedies are concerned. That's not the case for dietary supplements. For dietary supplements, the law that we have that regulates them is new, relatively speaking. We've only had it since 1994. And we had it, and we got it, because the FDA was so troubled by abuses that were evident in the marketing of what were being called dietary supplements and herbal medicines, that the FDA was considering banning them completely from being manufactured and imported. And that from that arose a great hue and cry, led principally by the manufacturers of these things, but also supported by folks who wanted to have access to these medications. And so we got this law, but as we'll discover tomorrow, if you're going to be here tomorrow, I'll go over these laws. I went over these laws on Monday, but that was for a crowd that was most of which was departing on Monday. And so it's important to have a perspective on these laws, so we'll do that tomorrow. But the point of this is that the regulation that comes by way of that law for the dietary supplements and herbal medicines amounts to essentially no regulation for these drugs when you compare them to the regulation for the over-the-counter drugs that we'll talk about today. So there are two distinct classifications there, and it's very important that consumers appreciate that difference. Any health professionals in the group here?
I'm the RN from last night.
Oh, right, sure.
Great. Medical, surgical, nursing.
Yeah, excellent, okay. last night I put out what I always put out here as the cardinal principles of pharmacology, of drug action, something that most people don't appreciate. I would put these every year when I would start my course in pharmacology for the medical students. I would hit these students right off the bat with this and force them to commit these to memory. And I mention them just because now this is an important way that everybody should look at drugs. All drugs are poisons. There isn't a single drug, there isn't a single substance that we can put into our bodies that doesn't have the potential to be toxic. It's really what separates toxicity from therapeutic, a therapeutic effect is dosage. No drug has a single action. I mentioned this last night, that when you take your headache medicine, take an aspirin for your headache, most folks are just thinking about the headache, and they're thinking that the aspirin is going to go take care of that headache. Well, it will, but the aspirin is doing other things in the body as well. Yes.
The establishment of dosage and its application, the application of that dosage across the population, how is that, you know, it's kind of the same dose for
sure.
Everybody depending on weight,
yeah,
and everything else?
Yeah, excellent question. And the answer to that is yes, partly. The dosage that is the usual dose that is put on the label of these over-the-counter medicines, and the usual dosage that is set for the physicians to use when they prescribe medications, is derived from studies of dosage in the human population, and looking at a range of doses. What does it take? What it really amounts to is how much does it take of this given drug to produce the desired effect in about 2/3 of the population.
Oh, okay.
And that number is what becomes the usual dose, give or take. But it's the point is that the usual dose is not designed to cover 100% of the population. And so some folks are going to be underdosed at that usual dose and would require a little bit more.
Are physicians able to adjust the
dosage? Sure. And you can too. I mean, this is the beauty of an understanding of pharmacology and drug action. And it goes down to my bottom point here. The proper dose of a drug is enough of it to do what you want it to do. And so I always make the point, I made the point last night when we talked about cold medicines, but I repeatedly make the point with folks like this, that if you can get the over-the-counter medicine that you're interested in a liquid form, then you are in a much better shape to be able to monitor the dosage to the point that it's doing what you want it to do. Because some tablets you can break in half. It's difficult to break them evenly into smaller amounts. But, you know, if the dosage is 2 teaspoons full and you feel you're not getting quite what you need from this, well, you can take maybe up to 3 teaspoons or 2 and 2.5 or something and just see if this helps. If it helps, then fine. You know, the risk, of course, is that as you go up in dose, as you go up in dose, you recruit other responses. And so the types of actions that a particular drug may produce may not be seen, well, some of them may not be seen at a low dose, but they will be seen at a higher dose. And if these are the disagreeable side effects, well, then that's where there's an issue when you begin to increase your dosage to try and get a more intense therapeutic effect. So that's the trade-off that's there. But the liquid dosage form of the product gives you much more control, much better control over dosage. This is especially important, I think, when we're dealing with cough medicines. Okay, good question. There are some assumptions that are made by the FDA in assigning a drug to be eligible for use over the counter. These are conditions that are generally self-limiting. Say this another way, over-the-counter drugs will not cure anything. They're not curative. They're just simply being used to relieve symptoms of a condition like cold that is going to get better on its own. This would also apply to the aches and pains of muscle strains. They're going to get better eventually. You may not think so right away, but they will get better. Even pain of sore joints and so on associated with early kinds of arthritis, that kind of pain is cyclic as well. It'll come and go. And the idea of taking an over-the-counter remedy to help alleviate these symptoms is with the idea that you won't have to take these drugs continuously. It's also assumed that the conditions that one would seek over-the-counter drugs for are ones that people can diagnose themselves without being medical professionals. You can tell when you have a cold. You can tell when you're having an allergic reaction. You can tell when you sprained your ankle. This sort of thing. And it's also assumed that drugs for self-medication are safe and effective. But safety and effectiveness are relative terms. The FDA has a requirement for all of the conventional over-the-counter drugs that are on the market that they be demonstrated to be safe and effective. That's safe and effective to the satisfaction of the FDA. That doesn't mean 100% safe. It does not mean 100% effective. Nothing is 100% safe. There is a risk with anything that we do. We're assuming a risk when we sit here that there won't be an earthquake and the roof falling on us or some such. I mean, so the risk isn't very great that that's necessarily going to happen. But the point is, there is no absolute here when we're talking about drug action. Now, last night, how many of you were here last night? Okay, so let me close the door on a room that I opened last night as we were talking about over-the-counter cold remedies. And where I was going to go, if we had enough time, was into some of the marketing ploys that manufacturers use to get you to buy their product. One of which is to make, in the case of cold remedies, is to make a distinction between whether or not it's a cold remedy or a flu remedy. And if you look at the list of ingredients for these drugs, and this is this representative group that I showed last night, what you find is that what distinguishes a flu medication from a conventional cold medicine is whether or not it has an analgesic. That's all. And I made the point that is there anybody in this room that doesn't keep a supply of ibuprofen or aspirin or Tylenol in their medicine cabinet? No, everybody's has this. Why buy it in another product? And especially if you've got the flu, and you've got Robitussin cough and cold on hand, and you like that for your cold symptoms, and now you think you've got the flu, and so they would like you to dash out and buy Robitussin cough and cold and flu. And you can accomplish the same thing just by taking a pain medicine. Okay. And in fact, I don't understand why they don't include the pain medicine. If they're going to include it in the flu remedy, why not in the cold remedy as well? But that's about the only thing I take when I have a cold is a little bit of ibuprofen for the headache or the sore throat and so forth. But anyway, this is a marketing ploy. Here's another one. Now, I'm picking on Theraflu here, but we could do this with any of the families of cold remedies. These are all Theraflu. If you go to the Theraflu website, you'll see all of these products lined up nicely, and they've all got their little bits of their title that tells you what they think is unique about them. This one has maximum allowable dosage of the various ingredients. This one is for nighttime severe cough and cold, because they put in diphenhydramine, which will actually, in this context, they would like you to think that it's going to do double duty, that it'll make you drowsy, and that it'll also suppress a cough. Now, a dose of 25 milligrams of diphenhydramine is probably not going to do either one of those, but that's what they've got in mind. The daytime severe cough and cold is basically the same thing, except they've substituted this other cough suppressant, and so on. And you look through here, but look at this. These three, flu and sore throat, cold and sore throat, sinus and cold, these are identical products. The only difference is that there is an effective dose of acetaminophen, Tylenol, basically, in this one, and these are substandard doses. This is half the usual dose of acetaminophen. Why they do that, I have no clue. But everything else in here is identical. It's the same product. Of course, they would like you to, if you've got the flu, to get this one, and if you think your sinuses are stuffy, then you get this one, and you know they'd like you to have them all. And then I made the point last time that I don't think there's a rational basis for putting a cough suppressant in one of these combination cold remedies, because not every cough should be suppressed. And you should be the one who makes the decision on whether or not a cough should be suppressed. Is your cough productive? If the answer is yes, don't suppress it. Live with it. If it's dry and hacking and not productive, keeping you awake, then sure. Then suppress it, but don't do it with this. This is in the low range of effectiveness dose. The proper dose really to suppress a cough with dextromethorphan is more like 30 milligrams.
So, yes. Where's the quickest, easiest, least confusing place to find this information, like online? Like, what's an effective dose of this? Do I really need?
Like, what are the brand names of these drugs? What's the best resource? You can get some of this information at a place like MayoClinic.com.
Okay.
You might be able to get it at a place like WebMD.com. What I would do for a particular remedy is I would Google that remedy. And I would Google the remedy, and then I'd say review.
Yeah.
And then you'll get a bunch of reviews. Now, you have to sort through the ones from the folks who are trying to sell it or the folks who don't know what they're talking about with their blogs and stuff. But you may find something from the NIH. You may find something from the FDA.
Yeah.
In fact, go to the FDA website and Google cold remedies, or not Google, do a search for cold remedy or whatever it is you're looking for. There you will find some information, good information. In my experience, you have to kind of hunt for it at that website.
Yeah, and that's why you just said government website. I'm like, oh. Because I'm just trying to think, okay, what can I quick look up on my phone at the pharmacy? But it sounds like perhaps
well, that's not... Now, were you here? You weren't here last night.
Yeah, I was.
Oh, you were. Okay. Now, as far as a cold remedy is concerned, about the only thing that's of any utility that's in a cold remedy is a decongestant.
Okay.
And maybe an antihistamine. Okay. You can find products that have just those in them. And that would be the way to go.
Dextromethorphan, you said that was the...
That's the state of the art for cough suppressant that has, if there's anything that has anything close to no side effects, it's dextromethorphan at the dosage that is used to suppress coughs.
Okay.
Yeah.
Another question as well.
Yeah.
I wasn't here last night, but this is, you know, as a layperson, this
sure,
is pretty distressing to hear that. As a consumer, you would have to understand seven-syllable words.
Well, you don't have to.
Most of us can't.
I know, but you don't have to. You don't have to.
But my question is really is, why is this amount of, I would call it borderline disinformation or borderline helpful information, not this, but what you find on labels, why is that, what's the culture that allows that?
Well, the culture is great. The culture is changing. The labels on over-the-counter remedies have been evolving for the last 20 years. They provide much better information now that is understandable by most folks, and you don't have to know the names of the drugs, because the requirement now is that for the label, this label would say acetaminophen, it'd be a line, and it would say pain reliever. It would say phenyramine, antihistamine. It would say phenylephrine, decongestant. And so they have to tell you what the class of the drug is. The assumption is that any drug that's in these remedies has been proven safe and effective. For the most part, that's true. But as I said last night, there's really no rationale, in my humble view, for an expectorant, for the analgesic, for the antihistamine even, and the cough suppressant in a combination remedy. And so if you just say, all right, I don't need any of those drugs, I've got my analgesic at home, I've got a cough suppressant remedy at home, the most I'm going to buy is a product that's got a decongestant and maybe an antihistamine. It's going to be real hard to find one that's just got a decongestant.
I have to comment. I appreciate what you're saying about that labels have gotten better, but I still feel duped because, you know, you're saying that
sure. If
you get like cough and cold medicine, it will say that it's intended use. But you are saying that, okay, well, on a bottle of Tylenol PM, it will have the stuff that you said was in Benadryl, but it won't say antihistamine. It says sleep aid. So if
right. It
has multiple uses,
that's a problem.
Then it's going to be under something different. So I'm looking at the seven syllable words, and it's just getting a little overwhelmed.
Well, I understand, and this is really an issue. And this is why we're having these kinds of discussions. But
what's enabling that, though? Is it a market? A completely marketing? Is it free market? Is it free reign? Is it total out of control?
Well,
is it
it's
an extension of
that. It's all that plus public demand. The American people said loud and clear in 1994, we want to self-medicate, and we want to do it with these supplements and these herbal remedies, regardless of what the FDA has to say about it. And so that's reflected here as well. Historically, self-medication has been the way things happened in the United States back into the beginnings of the United States. We only have had prescription drugs since 1954. And to make the distinction between prescription only and over the counter. And that distinction was made because after World War II, the chemical industries, the drug industries just went berserk and brought out all sorts of wonderful new drugs that did all sorts of wonderful new things, some of which turned out not to be so wonderful, but the basic thing was that these were all good things. But these were potentially more dangerous than what folks had been using prior to that, and they were conditions that most folks would not be able to diagnose on their own. So this is a cultural thing, and in other countries as well. I mean, it's just part of, I don't know if you noticed the quote that I had on that first slide, that, you know, the desire to take medicine is what defines us as people, as human beings. Okay. Somebody want to say something?
Well, I just one comment. Going back to the confusion at the drugstore, I found that if I don't know something, I'll just ask the pharmacist.
Yeah.
And you know, if it's a decent pharmacist, he's not really inclined to sell any one product. He just knows the drugs. So if I tell him my symptoms, I tell him what I want to accomplish, he generally will lead me to what I'm looking for.
That's a very good point. Pharmacy education, I've been through pharmacy education. Pharmacy education is aimed at creating an individual who is a walking encyclopedia of drug information. And your point about them not wanting to be promoting any particular product is valid. This is a big deal that's drilled into the pharmacist's head in terms of the ethics of being a pharmacist. And if anything, people do not take enough advantage of the pharmacist.
True.
What you'll find, scratch a pharmacist and you'll find somebody who will just begin to give you information. That's what they live for. And, and this is just the reality of what pharmacy training is about. And so by all means, instead of doing your searching,
no, I do ask the pharmacist, and I'm just thinking, I have to ask you what pharmacy you go to, because that's my first line is asking the pharmacist, and
so
I'm usually going to shrug.
Is it just so busy? Is that
no,
you
I
find
just,
the problem?
I think maybe it's just, maybe the head pharmacist isn't
well, then go find another pharmacy. I mean,
I've gone to several, because usually they're like, any of them on that area are fine.
Well, that's, in the case of pain remedies, in the case of cold remedies, any of them are okay. If you say, but what you have to do is say, I don't want one with the pain remedy in it. I don't want one with the expectorant in it. And you know, you define this. Now this pharmacist, if he's really on his toes, or she, or on their toes, they're going to say, now here's somebody that I can talk to. And they'll set you up. We can take a couple minutes here and talk about some of the other remedies that are out there as promoted as cold remedies. These would be ones that, for the most part, are on the fringe. They're not conventional over-the-counter medicines, but they're out there, like echinacea. This is an herbal remedy. The bottom line on echinacea is that maybe there is some mild effectiveness here in association with reducing the symptoms of a cold or reducing the duration of a cold. I'm aware of one study that their landmark conclusion was that it reduced the duration of a cold by 1 day. You know, to me that's not very impressive. But
you could be really sick.
It is if you're really sick.
Like starfish.
And so my point here is echinacea is the jury is still out in echinacea, but there are people who swear by it. And if you want to give it a go. Come back tomorrow, and we'll talk about what you have to look for when you are looking for an herbal remedy or one of these dietary supplements. What you have to beware of. But in terms of whether or not it might work, this is something that is an open question at the moment. Vitamin C, we've had this one around now for, 30 or 40 years, thanks to Linus Pauling and his notions. As it happens, he was partly correct, but he was also partly wrong. Vitamin C, folks take vitamin C, it's promoted as something that'll keep you from getting colds. There's no evidence to support this. The evidence that it prevents colds is really, really not good at all. However, there is some pretty good evidence that if you take about 200 milligrams as you feel a cold coming on, 200 milligrams or more within reason, this may actually shorten the duration, cut it in half perhaps, with some folks, of the cold, reduce the severity of the symptoms. You get arguments either way on this, but the literature does seem to support that notion. Linus was a big proponent of megadose therapy with vitamin C. Megadose meaning on the order of grams, several grams a day. This turns out not to, and it was related to the idea that it would prevent colds, would prevent cancer. That's all been shown to be completely discredited.
But do you have any idea how many millions or thousands or billions of dollars our country pours into vitamin C?
Sure, tons of them.
I mean,
tons
it's such a huge,
it's a huge market.
It's like an industry now.
Sure, and you deal with people who are believers and say, I don't care what you say. It works for me, and I'm going to do it. And if it means that I'm not going to get cancer, then I'm willing to spend this money. That's fine. I say, okay, do
but
that.
How do you test that?
Very hard to test.
Well, on one person, because if I take vitamin sure. C and get cancer, I can't say, wonder what would have happened if I hadn't taken vitamin C.
Right. And the only way you can test this is with long-term studies, and there have been a couple of those. Mayo Clinic did a classical one, the one that really put the nail in this coffin. They looked for at a population for years where some of them were getting high doses of vitamin C, and the incidence of cancer in that group was the same. And so that's the conclusion. Now, is that convincing from a scientific standpoint? Well, you know, I as a scientist would say, well, you always like to have corroborative studies that repeat this. Look at this study, say, well, there was a little bit of a shortcoming here, let's improve on that. But these long-term studies are really hard to do. They're very expensive, and obviously they take a long time. But that's the word on vitamin C. Zinc is a real interesting one. Several years ago, based on the notion that zinc can actually prevent the implantation, I guess, of viruses in the airway, cold viruses in the airway. This is what led to our having a bunch of products with zinc lozenges, and they're still around. And they were highly touted as reducing the duration of colds by about 3 days, by about half. And in fact, these are very good studies, and this is what zinc does. The evidence is really quite solid, I think. The problem with zinc, and the reason that everybody's not taking it, is that most people who tried these lozenges said, yuck, I'd rather suffer the cold than consume these lozenges because they taste terrible. And then on top of that, we know that there's a relatively rare, but potentially far more serious and disagreeable side effect in which a sense of taste can be completely abolished or completely defeated permanently. And there are cases of this having happened, and there were big lawsuits of a company, Zicam, here not too recently.
Really?
For having that problem.
Is yes. that specific to the lozenges? Because I take a zinc supplement.
No. Oh, yeah, right. This is because the lozenges contain a lot of zinc. The zinc supplement doesn't have that kind of dosage. Yeah. No, for taking a zinc supplement, that's no big deal.
Didn't they say the same thing about the nasal spray, that was not good?
And the nasal spray as well. It was just, this was an issue of putting high concentrations of zinc into the region where your taste and smell sensors are and poisoning them. That's what it amounted to. That doesn't happen with systemically taken zinc in the supplements. The concentrations don't get that high.
So the reason why zinc works, is it because zinc is involved in a lot of biochemical processes?
Well, it's thought that it's involved specifically in the process that permits the cold virus to get itself situated on a cell and then begin to do what viruses do, which is to...
So it prevents binding.
Yeah, it prevents the binding of the virus to the cell. That's what is believed to be the case. Just a word about antibiotics. No one should be taking antibiotics. You shouldn't be able to get them. You can't get them over the counter, but a lot of people who get antibiotics for an infection may not take them all, which they're supposed to take them all, and they keep them around, and then they get a cold, and they take an antibiotic for the cold. This is bad. It should not be done. First of all, the antibiotics are effective against bacteria. They're not effective against viruses. Secondly, you take an antibiotic and it kills off susceptible bacteria and allows sort of the evolutionary process to the natural selection process for bugs that are not susceptible to the antibiotic to reproduce and to grow. And you end up with problem that we have in the hospitals now of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. So no one should be messing with antibiotics under any circumstances unless a doctor tells you to do it, but certainly not for the treatment of the common cold.
Has the FDA ever cracked down on doctors that prescribe antibiotics for virus infections?
No. This is the FDA doesn't get involved in practice issues. The ones that get on their case are their the medical societies. They have their standards that they set, and they I don't know that they punish their members for doing this, but they try to make it really clear that they shouldn't do this. And virtually every physician understands what we just said, but some physicians give in to their patients clamoring for antibiotics. Anybody heard of this thing? Acylococcinum?
Bacteria. Is it a bacteria?
Well, supposedly it's a bacteria. I'm glad no one has heard of this. Although this is one of the widest sold cold and flu remedies out there. This is a homeopathic remedy. And come back on Friday and we'll talk about homeopathic remedies.
No, we're going to talk about it today and leave it tomorrow.
Well, the deal with acylococcinum is that this is supposedly a bacteria that was discovered in duck liver by somebody years and years and years and years ago, and was attributed or was somehow related to treatment of and prevention of colds and flu. I don't quite know the full history there, but what we've come to know, and in the homeopathic setting, a homeopathic remedy is characterized by being diluted to the point. The belief among the homeopathic community is that the more you dilute a drug, the more powerful it becomes, which is just opposite to what a classical pharmacologist like me would say, is that the more drug that you give, the higher the dose, the more intense will be the response. Well, it's just the reverse in homeopathy. This thing is diluted in under ordinary circumstances 1 to 10, 200 times. Now, any of you know your scientific notation, we're talking about taking a speck of this stuff and putting it in a volume that's probably larger than the Earth. Okay? That's the extent to which this is diluted. There is no molecule of that stuff in a bottle that you have that has been diluted that much. Moreover, no one has ever been able to confirm that this thing even exists. So this is not, you won't find this listed in a bacteriology book. Okay, so that sort of leads up to the point that we're going to have a lot of fun talking about homeopathy.
I was going to say, tell me how over-the-counter and homeopathic stuff, how's that regulated? What's the difference?
That's an interesting one. It's covered, homeopathic remedies are covered under the Food and Drug Act of 1938. Mm-hmm. However, what's covered there is just simply what it is, a description of what's regulated is the way the product is manufactured and the way that the label states what's in the product. It doesn't have to say how much of the substance is there, because there's hardly anything there in the first place. And homeopathic remedies are exempt from having to establish evidence of safety and efficacy. So basically they're not covered. They're certainly not covered the way conventional over-the-counter drugs are covered.
Right.
Well, okay. Well, we've got time to go through a few of these things. I wanted to cover sunscreens. Because the rules are changing on sunscreens. I think they'll be changed in maybe a year, officially they'll go into effect, but most manufacturers are already changing their labeling and what the product contains. Sunscreens protect us from ultraviolet radiation, and there are three types of ultraviolet radiation. There's that's called A, B, and C, UVA, UVB, UVC. UVA is what penetrates deeply into the skin. It affects our melanin content of the skin, stimulates production of melanin. That's what tans us. That's what turns the skin brownish. UVA can also burn, but it's not as severe a burning radiation as the UVB. UVB is what really causes a sunburn. The $2 word for this is erythema. It is also the radiation that's most likely to be carcinogenic. I don't think carcinogenesis is ruled out here, but it's considered to be much, much less of a problem than with UVB. UVB radiation also causes what's called photoaging, where someone is out in the sun for decades, spends decades, their skin turns kind of wrinkly and discolored. That's photoaging, and that's caused by the UVB. UVC is an interesting one. It's there. It doesn't get to the earth. So we don't get it from the sun, but we do get it in tanning salons. And so, and it's highly carcinogenic. But the carcinogenic potential is presumably related to how much exposure a person gets. But it's this one is it's interesting that this one is the most carcinogenic.
And I don't understand how tanning salons can even be allowed.
Demand.
I just don't get that.
Demand again. Listen. There are even products out there, I'm not even going to talk about them, they're sort of not so much in vogue anymore, but there are pills that you can take that give you an artificial tan.
Oh, dear.
And what these contain, they're basically carrot tablets. Beta carotene is what's there, mm-hmm. and it gives you sort of it'll give you kind of a reddish color, and it comes up from below. And for some people, this is considered to be a tan. The tan that you get from the sun actually does protect from burn and from carcinogenesis. The melanin absorbs the radiation to some degree. With the artificial tanning things, your skin changes color, but there's no protection there. This is, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, this is one of the big scams that's out there. But fortunately, it's I don't think there are that many people that use it anymore.
Oh, I disagree.
Well, maybe it's true. You know, vanity drives folks to do a lot of things. When you buy a sunscreen, you'll see on the label SPF. That stands for sun protection factor. This is an indicator of how effective the sunscreen in the product is. And what it does is reduce the time that it takes to burn, and the SPF is an indicator of that time. For example, if you're fair-skinned and if you burn after 20 minutes in the sun, a product with an SPF 2 will extend that time to 40 minutes. You won't get burned. It'll take twice as long for you to get burned. An SPF 12 will take this 20 minutes out to 4 hours. An SPF 30 out to 10 hours. Now, if you don't get into the sun until 1 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, you're protected even when the sun is down, which is kind of silly. But that's what these SPF numbers are reflecting. Okay, it just extends the amount of time that you can stay in the sun until you burn. But it applies only as long as the sunscreen remains on the skin and remains active. If you go swimming or if you are sweating heavily in the heat, then this is going to shorten the time that you can be out there because it's going to remove some of the sunscreen. And an interesting property of many of the sunscreen products that are available, I'll tell you which ones, are that as they absorb the UV radiation, they become inactivated. The radiation inactivates the chemicals, and so there has to be reapplication. And some people think that if you put on the sunscreen and then like put on an SPF 12 and then half an hour later, you reapply SPF 12. That's the same as applying SPF 24. That's not. It does not, multiples of applications do not change the number. If it's SPF 12, then all you get from this is the prolongation of the time that it takes you to burn for whatever that time is for you. Okay.
This is a time to burn equation. Does that change based on the sunburn index of the day? Or how is that?
I don't know that it gets that complicated. It's really, I think it's aimed at the individuals. The individual has to decide. I'm a quick burner. I'm a slow burner. And that's the context. What you'll see here is that what it comes down to is that most people are going to want to have an SPF higher than 20 or 30 anyway, because you get into the realm where you're completely protected from with the higher SPFs. Here's just a reflection of this range that some folks would recommend that you don't need to go much beyond SPF 11 if you don't burn very easily, and it's only if you are really sensitive to burning that you need these high numbers. Where this may be important is that at least I've seen that the price goes up with SPF in some cases. Anything above about SPF 20 is giving you what amounts to maximal protection. Now, there are some things to appreciate about sunscreens. There are some hazards associated with sunscreens. They shouldn't be used in infants below 6 months of age for a couple of reasons. One is that these sunscreens get absorbed through the skin to a small degree, and so there is some systemic absorption. In an infant, especially a very young infant, that infant's ability to eliminate drugs, which we have in a very efficient manner, they may not have. It may not have been developed yet. And thus the chemicals can accumulate in these infants and cause toxicity. And so this is the reason why the label will say don't use this in infants below 6 months, and certainly don't use it willy-nilly with the idea that if you slather it on the kid is protected. Maybe protected from the sun, not necessarily protected from the systemic toxicity. Similarly, in the elderly, our melanin production decreases after about age 30, so it's not even elderly we're talking about necessarily here.
Age-old question is my
answer. Right.
What is elderly?
I started with these headings, and then I've been adding to them, and I forgot what I had done.
The old saying, never tan anyone older than 30.
Yeah, right. The problem with losing your ability to produce melanin as well as you did when you were young is that the risk of photosensitivity reactions occurring goes up. And photosensitivity reactions are things that happen with certain kinds of medications. You'll see this on the label of over-the-counter drugs where that's a problem, and you'll especially get that information when you get a prescription drug that has the tendency to be associated with photosensitivity reactions. You'll get warned about this by, if not by the pharmacist themselves, by material that comes with it. Selecting a sunscreen. Now, here's where it becomes important. Now that we understand that UVA and UVB are important radiation wavelengths to protect against, and knowing that prior to the advent of these new regulations, the sunscreen products that were available really only protected against UVB. They don't protect against UVA. Now we have new chemicals now that protect against UVA and UVB, and we call them now so-called broad spectrum. And so what you want to do is select products that have these. These are the broad spectrum sunscreens. And forget about the fact that these are multi-syllabic. If you look on the label and you see zone in the name, it's a broad spectrum sunscreen. These absorb UV radiation. Then there's an old standby, zinc oxide, the white stuff that you smear on your nose, and titanium dioxide. I think it may also be colored, but I don't know for sure. These are even better sunscreens than these, because they reflect the radiation. These absorb the radiation, but as I said, the radiation inactivates them as time goes by over the course of a couple of hours. These don't get inactivated by the radiation. Of course, you don't really want to walk around with zinc oxide all over your body. The ones to avoid, unless they are combined with these benzones, are the ones that you find in the standard sunscreens that are out there now, Pava, Pavamato, Sinoxate, and so on. But if they're in a product that contains one or more of these sunscreens, then it's okay. These give you the broad coverage. These give you additional coverage for UVB, but they only absorb UVB.
Question, yeah. Did you warn us yesterday about trolamines?
Yeah, that I warned you about trolamine salicylate in the external analgesic products. Trolamine is also able to absorb UVB, and it does that very well. Okay, so here are the new rules. The labels are going to be able to say broad spectrum only if they've got the chemicals that cover both UVA and UVB. And I said the current ratings only apply to UVB. They're not, no longer going to be able to say this is sunblock. Okay. They're no longer going to be able to say it's waterproof or sweatproof unless they provide evidence to the FDA, and they'll say it on the label. And the evidence, if there's evidence that convinces the FDA that there's that these are waterproof or sweatproof, then they can do is say it's water resistant for 40 minutes or 80 minutes, depending on which one they showed to the satisfaction of the FDA. And this drives home the point that these things have to be reapplied.
So I'm guessing they'll still say sport on the bottle.
Sure.
In a tenth of you getting it because you think it's going to be sweatproof.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. They're going to be able to claim protection against skin cancer if it's above SPF 15. I inferred about 20, but SPF 15 is pretty well considered to be maximum protection now. So those are the new rules. How do you use a sunscreen? Most people don't use sunscreens properly. I don't. I hate them. But I have to use them. This last year, I had my first couple of little skin cancers that I had to remove. And so, you know, that's the wake-up call. So I use the damn things, but I don't like them. You're supposed to slather it on, okay? Most people don't use enough. The recommendation is a full fluid ounce, which is 6 teaspoons full, or more.
Wow.
If you're doing your whole body, if you're going to go out and lay in the sun. And put it on before you go out, because it takes time for this stuff to get absorbed properly into the skin and get situated so it's going to do what it's supposed to do, which is to absorb the UVA. I've read all sorts of things that say don't forget about the lips. They're very susceptible to sunburn, and there are special chapstick sorts of things that with sunscreen that you can get in this case. If you're going to be out in the sun for any length of time, know that you've got about 2 hours and then you've got to put it on again. And if you're swimming or toweling off for whatever reason, you're going to have to reapply it more often because of this thing about inactivation that I mentioned. Okay. And this idea, if you're in the water for 40 minutes or 80 minutes, it's gone, depending on which the product is. Yeah.
What about sprays? A lot of sports
deals sprays.
Are sprays, but it's really hard to get 6 ounces of spray on the run.
Yeah, well, the deal is, you know, smear it on so that you've got enough to move around. You know, spraying it I don't think, for a guy like me who's got hair all over my my arms, I'll spray it on, but then I'll have to
lather
around. That's the part I hate. Okay. Okay. Well, we're out of time, so we probably should just stop here. And although, let me just say, this one I can do real fast. If you're troubled with dry skin, the best remedy for dry skin is Vaseline. The whole idea about preventing dry skin is to prevent water from evaporating from your skin. That's the cause of dry skin. All of the products that are out there for moisturizing your skin are designed to put a covering on your skin that will retard evaporation. To make things cosmetically appealing to people, they go with lotions, they go with other sorts of things that are not as good a covering for the skin as that oily old Vaseline would be.
You hate that more than sunscreen, don't you?
I hate that even worse. But actually, no, I will use it in areas, you know, during the winter, your fingers get dried out and parched. Put Vaseline on, or even just put some just plain old Eucerin or something and put a Band-Aid around it. And that helps to retard evaporation. The whole point is retarding evaporation. Glycerin is used for dry skin. Glycerin draws water from the air, but it doesn't put it into the skin. By drawing it from the air, it retards evaporation as well. So glycerin works as well for dry skin. But the best thing is to cover it with something, cover the skin with something that will prevent evaporation. That's it. Let's go have lunch. And thanks for being here. And I hope you can make it tomorrow.